3, 2, 1, and we are live, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the T-Hatch Podcast, where we have open and in-depth conversations about the things that you and I care about. Today on the T-Hatch Podcast, I'm going to be breaking down a couple of the standout stories to me from the first days of the NBA playoffs, as well as a couple of stories from just around the NBA happening right now. So definitely excited to talk about that. I'm going to be talking about the 76ers and how they look without Ben Simmons, how they've been adjusting, or lack thereof, but we'll get more into that later. I'm going to be talking about the Kristaps Porzingis ejection and my thoughts there. I'm also going to be talking about LeBron and the Lakers a bit. We'll get more into that later. And actually a little bit of news about Masai Ujiri, the president of the Toronto Raptors. Again, we'll get more details later. So that is what we've got on the docket today for discussion. So I'm going to jump in with the 76ers. And to me, since losing Ben Simmons, the 76ers have actually looked even more lost without Ben Simmons on the floor, which I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around why that could be the case, other than what I'm going to lay out here, which is I believe that it is Brett Brown. I think he is the big problem here. So what we've seen since Ben Simmons has been taken off of the floor for the 76ers is we have seen the 76ers continue to play this mind-boggling style where they will sometimes try and get Joel Embiid post-ups, but every time they do, they feel the need to stick somebody else in the dunker spot for whatever reason. And it somewhat made sense when Ben Simmons were on the floor. And I think this is where a lot of the, oh, you need to trade either Simmons or Embiid sentiment has come from, which is just that it looked like because of Ben Simmons' lack of shooting ability that you had to stick him in that dunker spot opposite Embiid in the post. However, now that we're seeing them continue to do that, even with guys who can hit three-pointers, just sticking them in the dunker spot for whatever reason, no one really knows, it's just crazy to me. So now I'm starting to look at this situation in Philly and think, okay, well, there's definitely a strong chance now from seeing this that Ben Simmons has not been in the paint through any lack of ability on his end in the half-court offense, but rather that Brett Brown has been forcing Ben Simmons into that dunker spot because that's the role he needs out of that guy on the floor. You know, he needs to have a guy in the dunker spot. A recent video just went up on The Ringer by Kevin O'Connor where he broke down a little bit of what's going on here with the 76ers. Actually had the opportunity to ask Brett Brown about this and sort of asked it from the perspective of, hey, what are you thinking when you're deciding to go with a three-out approach with Embiid in the post as opposed to a four-out approach, putting four players at the three-point line? And really, Brett Brown's answer, and you should watch the video for the full answer in his context, but essentially it boiled down to, oh, well, I learned how to coach under Greg Popovich and the Spurs, and at that time, we had Tim Duncan and David Robinson and played two post players and always had a guy in that dunker spot. So in 2020, you have to have a guy in that dunker spot, even if they're not a dunker, and even if they can shoot three-pointers and space the floor? I don't get it. And of course, nobody should get it because all that Brett Brown is doing is staying locked in to an antiquated system that worked for a certain personnel set that particular Spurs team had. Now, the reason I put the emphasis on the personnel set is because we have seen from the Spurs and Greg Popovich, they have been one of the best teams in the NBA at adjusting to the roster that they have and adjusting their game plan to take advantage of the strength of those players. That's just what they happened to be doing at the time when they had Tim Duncan and David Robinson to take advantage of both of their skills. If you have two amazing post players on the offense, Yeah, you're going to put them both in the post and you're going to take advantage of that and put the defense in tough spots. But it doesn't work like that when you're putting Matisse Thybulle in the dunker spot. Is Matisse Thybulle going to grab a ball and just be able to dunk it down like a center? No, he's not. He's a small forward shooting guard type guy. He's a wing. He belongs out on the wing, not in the post. Now, obviously, basketball is a fluid game. Guys are going to end up in the post, out on the three, when they don't necessarily belong there permanently. Of course that's going to happen. But when you're running down the floor and every time that you try and set up your offense, every time that you try and get Joel Embiid a post up, you're going to stick somebody else in that dunker spot, even if they have no reason being there? Well, it's very clear now that you're the problem, Brett Brown. Your game plan is the problem. Your inability to change the game plan is the problem. And, you know, is it inability? Is it unwillingness? In my opinion, it's probably a little bit of both. But it's become clear to me that Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid are not the problem in Philly. It is Brett Brown. So I've done some episodes in the past saying, hey, they need to trade one of these guys. Apologies to Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons for suggesting that either of them should be traded, or for suggesting that this situation is their problem to begin with, because it's become clearer and clearer and clearer that they are not the problem in Philly. And I'm starting to wonder if we saw Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid playing on, say, the Toronto Raptors, even if the rest of the roster transferred over, you just swapped rosters and they had that front office with Nick Nurse coaching them, they'd be absolutely stellar, and we'd be talking about them as one of the best young NBA duos, and it would probably look legendary how they paired together, just because Nick Nurse is a coach who actually takes the players that he has and alters his game plan to fit those players, not the other way around, which we have seen time and time again does not work in the NBA, and especially in the modern NBA, where most of the game is finding mismatches and taking advantage of singular talents. Those are two things that Brett Brown has not embraced, and in fact has brushed them off and doesn't seem to want to do it. So if you're not going to embrace the modern game, if you're going to play an antiquated play style, unwilling to change it, and it doesn't work with your star players, yeah, at that point you gotta go. It's just plain and simple. And I know I've done it in the past, but I want to shy away from suggesting that guys need to be fired because, you know, Brett Brown is a guy. He's got a family. He's got to put food on the table, not to say he hasn't stacked away plenty of money from being a head coach in the NBA. But, you know, I don't like to see guys lose their livelihood, lose their job. But if you're going to continue to be unwilling to change and unable to do your job because of that unwillingness to change, well, the organization is going to have to make the change for you. So that's about the point that it's getting to. Now, I think Elton Brand does deserve a little bit of the blame on this one as well, just for being unable to put anybody next to Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons to help draw out their strengths. You know, putting together a roster that almost forces Brett Brown to play a proper play style to actually take advantage of those players. Although, as I just stated, I don't believe that would actually happen even if he did have the roster. But what we've seen with the way that Elton Brand has put this team together, he has unloaded what was an arsenal of draft picks and young assets, and what he's come away with is a depleted roster that's overpaying role players and is also paying for the retirement of Al Horford. He's basically going to go do three more farewell tours with the Sixers and then retire with a bunch of nice paychecks from the 76ers. So it's just been bad decision after bad decision from the Sixers, and on top of that, they've had an inability to follow through and make good on the decisions that they've made. A primary example being the Jimmy Butler trade. You unload, I think it was at least two first-round picks. I would have to double-check to get the specifics correct. But you unload a lot of assets to go get Jimmy Butler and pair him next to Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. And he did have chemistry, lots of it, with Joel Embiid. But your organization was so bad that Jimmy Butler did not want to come back to Philadelphia for any reason. There was no amount of money, no promises you could make to Jimmy Butler that would make him want to go back because his experience was that terrible. Don't take my word for it. Take Jimmy Butler's word for it. Go watch his podcast with JJ Redick. They went in depth on that situation and his decision to leave the Sixers. And he was not happy with how they treated him. He was not happy with how they approached the game of basketball, approached the work behind the scenes that is necessary to actually prepare yourselves to play NBA basketball at a high level. And that is a lot of what caused him to leave Philadelphia. And we're just seeing dysfunction on dysfunction on dysfunction from this team. And at this point, I can no longer lay any of the blame for their lack of success on the players on the Sixers, because it appears the organization around them is just so bad that it is unable to take advantage of the things that they are great at, which is unfortunate for a guy like Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, two incredible talents that are, you know, seemingly both once in a generation type guys, and seemingly both of them are going underutilized and not reaching their full potential. And it appears that that is because of this Philadelphia 76ers team. So hopefully they can get things together and get it moving in the right direction. One thing that I would like to see out of the Sixers would be to move on from Brett Brown as head coach and actually hire Kenny Atkinson, the former Brooklyn Nets head coach, because I believe Atkinson has shown an excellence at developing young players, as well as constantly tweaking his game plan to maximize the strength of his players. He's a guy who's not afraid to break out his own defense if that's what it takes to stop a particular team. He's not afraid of altering what they do on the offensive end to take advantage of the strengths that his players have. And you saw a lot of that happening in Brooklyn when you saw breakouts from guys like Spencer Dinwiddie, Caris LeVert, Jarrett Allen. The development there was great. And I think a lot of that credit should go to Kenny Atkinson. And I would love to see him get this job where he can help mentor and grow, develop Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons into those finished products, as well as altering the game plan enough to actually take advantage of the strengths of not just one of those players, but both of them at the same time. I think Atkinson would be up to the task, so I would like to see that happen, but of course, I'm not Elton Brand. I'm not the GM of the Philadelphia 76ers, so that's going to be up to Elton. So that's all I've got to add on the Sixers. I want to move on now to the Kristaps Porzingis ejection in Game 1 versus the Clippers. So Kristaps Porzingis was ejected in the third quarter, basically for showing emotion, which is, this is kind of crazy to me. So Porzingis was automatically ejected after being called for his second technical foul with 9 minutes and 10 seconds remaining in the third quarter. Dallas would later go on to lose the game 118-110. So it was a very close game that Porzingis most certainly would have made a difference on. Porzingis received his first technical after protesting a foul call against him with about 6 minutes remaining in the second quarter. Replays confirmed that Porzingis cleanly blocked Paul George's layup attempt, but he was called for the foul and assessed a technical after punching the air. Oh, he punched the air and shouted a few words. Oh my goodness, tee that man up. That's ridiculous. Now I should say, this is the rules. That is how the rule book is written. If you punch the air, you're going to get a technical foul. It's not just applying to Porzingis. It applies to everybody. So I'm not arguing that the refs did something stupid here. I'm not arguing that they're not doing their job or that Porzingis is getting treated unfairly, because all of that is fair. All of that is in the rules. I'm arguing that the rules are stupid. Why are we not allowing NBA players to show emotion? It's absolutely ridiculous to me. You know, why is Kyle Lowry getting a technical foul for yelling "and one"? And one, are you serious? Is that not yelled multiple times in every single pickup game of basketball that you have ever played? Is that not screamed out in every NBA game, every college basketball game, WNBA? Doesn't matter what basketball it is, everybody has said and won, and everybody knows that there's no malice behind that. Come on. Where are we at when yelling and one gets you a technical foul? Where are we at when you get a technical foul for staring at another player? Are you joking? Are we not allowed to show emotion out there on the basketball court? It's getting ridiculous out here that guys are getting teed up for being human, for emoting. You gotta be joking. I mean, at this point, if the NBA continues down this path, they're gonna start looking like the MLB. It is just getting boring, lifeless, and slow if they keep calling these stupid ticky-tack technical fouls for things that nobody cares about. Let the players talk trash to each other. It's great. Let the players get a little chippy. It's great. Now, in the case of Porzingis, he did come up, give a little push. Morris pushed back. I think if you get to a point where guys are given some good hard shoves, you do need to consider assessing some technical fouls. So I'm not going to crap on that particular technical foul. I am on the first one, though. Yelling a few words and punching in the air, that's a technical foul. Come on. Come on, NBA. It's ridiculous. You're robbing the game of emotion, which, as we know, fuels the game of basketball. It is a game of confidence, bravado, emotion, and being within the moment. That emotion creates such amazing clutch moments in NBA games that you just don't see often in other sports. Now, you know, it's not to say that basketball has a monopoly on clutch moments, but the combination of your ability to personalize with the players, since you can directly see them, there are only five guys on each team playing at any given moment, you get acquainted with these guys, you get acquainted with their emotion, and you get bought into the game. When that starts flaring up and guys are showing that emotion out there on the floor, and then you get down to an intense moment when the game's on the line with a few seconds left, everybody is on the edge of their seat. Everybody's on their feet, honestly. And it just becomes such an amazing, energized moment that is not only amazing for the players, but it is amazing for the fans. That is what basketball fans live for. Are we going to rob that from NBA fans by taking emotion out of the game because we want to call a few technical fouls to make sure that players don't punch the air? Come on. Ease up. And play a game. That's what this is at the end of the day. Basketball is a game. The NBA is entertainment. Play the game. Entertain us. That's what we want. We don't want lifeless robots out here to shoot three, high efficiency shot, layup, three-pointer. No. That's not what anybody wants. No, we want to see an emotional, fun game that is packed with the passion of all these players who work tirelessly day and night to be as good as they are at the game of basketball. And they should be allowed to show that passion out there on the court when it matters most. So at this point, I'm in full-on rant mode, so I'm going to move on from this one. But I definitely think some rule changes are needed moving into next season to get this in check, because it's getting ridiculous. So next, moving on to LeBron James and the Lakers, and they actually lost to the Portland Trailblazers in game one. One of the things that I found interesting here that I really wanted to point out, because I have not had time to review the tape from that game, so I wanted to focus on what happened before the game with LeBron and the rest of the Lakers deciding to wear what were essentially MAGA hats, but instead it said, "Make America arrest the cops who killed Breonna Taylor." So LeBron James and all of the Lakers wore those hats heading into game one. And for me, I thought it was a very bold statement, and I think an incredible move. So I initially criticized LeBron when we were coming into the bubble, because he decided he did not want to wear any of the approved messages on the back of his jersey, opting to just have his name. And I criticized that because my feelings on that are that LeBron is a incredibly impactful brand, person, personality, however you want to put it, in the United States of America. And, you know, seeing him throughout an entire playoff run wearing a social justice message on his back, seeing those highlights, those pictures live on in immortality, would have been huge. And I still think he should have done that. However, I do agree with LeBron on the sentiment that the idea that they just have to pick from an approved list kind of defeats the entire purpose. And I agree with LeBron on that. So I think this was a masterful play where he decided, okay, I'm going to wait till the start of the playoffs to actually make a move here. I'm going to decline to put a message on my jersey to send the message to the NBA that I don't like that. And then when it comes time for the start of the NBA playoffs, I'm going to come out and make a huge statement and make it in dramatic fashion. And I think that's exactly what he was able to pull off, him and the Lakers, I should say, because obviously getting an entire team of people to make a political statement is no easy feat, and that is not an individual thing. So I think they all deserve credit here for making what I think was a pretty calculated and savvy move, in my opinion, to be able to make a point that he wanted to make at the time he wanted to make it and maximize the impact of that point. I think he did a great job. So now I want to move on to the final story that I wanted to talk about, and that is Masai Ujiri. So if you guys remember, from the 2019 NBA Finals, when the Toronto Raptors won the NBA Finals, Masai Ujiri was trying to enter the court to go celebrate with the team and ends up in a little bit of a shoving match with a police officer who was working security at the event over, you know, essentially his credentials to get onto the court. So initially, it was just kind of this weird video of like, whoa, did Masai Ujiri just shove a cop? What's happening here? So we see the video, all that stuff. Masai eventually gets on the court. People kind of forget about it for a while. Then in February, the officer decided to file suit against Masai Ujiri. So obviously that's long gone. That's been going on for a while. What's new here? Well, Masai Ujiri has actually filed a countersuit against Alan Strickland, the police officer who pushed Ujiri in the video that we will watch shortly, who previously filed suit against Ujiri in February, claiming that Ujiri assaulted him in the moments after Toronto's victory, and that as a result of the incident, he suffered injury to his body, health, strength, activity, and person, all of which have caused and continue to cause the plaintiff great mental, emotional, psychological, physical, and nervous pain and suffering. Ooh. Ooh. Well, Masai filed countersuit because new video evidence has become available of Alan Strickland initiating the confrontation. So what we see in this new video, which I will play for you now, but what we saw in the video was Masai Ujiri go to pull out his team credentials to show the officer. As he's doing so, he gets grabbed by the suit coat and shoved. At which point he says, what the heck is going on? Goes to show him his credential again, right to his face. Hey, this is my credential. I'm trying to get on the court. I'm the president of the Toronto Raptors. At which point he gets shoved again. No attempt for communication. He gets told to back the F up by Strickland. And of course, he used the actual word. This is YouTube, so I can't. And then, after shoving Masai Ujiri twice, then Masai Ujiri finally responds and shoves him back in the chest. Now, this officer, after this confrontation, after starting a confrontation in which he was in the wrong, he decides, oh, I'm going to go ahead and file suit against Masai Ujiri for the mental and emotional pain and agony. Oh. Well, I'm going to call you Snowflake Strickland from now on, because that's what you are. You're a little snowflake. Oh my goodness! I got pushed by a man that I shoved twice and didn't listen to. Oh, I'm never gonna recover. I'm a police officer who got pushed. Oh. Really, dude? Really? Grow the F up. Come on. Now, we shouldn't be surprised, though, that this is what Strickland is doing, because Strickland is doing what cops do. What they do is try to create legal consequences for somebody who did not accept their abuse. That's what Strickland is doing here. That's what he was doing when he decided to file suit against Masai Ujiri. And thankfully, Ujiri is standing up for himself and the rest of us when he says, no, that is not what happened, and I will not allow you to do this to me or anybody else. So thank you, Masai Ujiri, for filing a countersuit. The unfortunate part to me in this is that there likely will be no serious repercussions for Strickland, as the United States is clearly not interested in holding law enforcement officers accountable. So Strickland can come out here, be his little snowflake baby self, and file a lawsuit against Masai Ujiri to try and get him legal consequences when Strickland was clearly in the wrong. And now Masai Ujiri has to file a counter lawsuit just to get himself absolved from the BS that Strickland is trying to create for him, because Masai Ujiri would not accept that Strickland was going to abuse him and abuse his power that night and not allow Masai Ujiri entrance onto the court, which he clearly had access for. So again, thank you, Masai Ujiri. Thank you to the lawyers and the legal representation of Masai Ujiri for continuing this litigation and pushing back against Strickland and his BS allegations here, where he is trying to continue to abuse Masai Ujiri after he was unsuccessful at doing it the first time. So thank you again, Masai Ujiri. But that was all I had to add to this topic. That was all I had to add for the NBA playoffs for this first couple days. I am super excited to watch the rest of the playoffs as they play out and talk more actual basketball. So definitely excited. Stay tuned for more of that coming. But with that all out the way, I definitely appreciate you tuning into the podcast today. As always, if you enjoy the show and want to see it grow, the absolute best way to do so is to simply share this with your friends. So go ahead and hit the like button, share, subscribe. You guys know what to do. So with that all out the way, I'm going to let you get back to the rest of your day. Peace.